This time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity for questions with instructions given at that time. If you should require assistance during the conference call, please press star then zero. And as a reminder, today's conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to your host, Emily James. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Welcome to today's press call to discuss the Division I Committee on Infractions decision regarding Oklahoma State University. As members of the media, you should have received a link to both the press release and the public decision, which contains the details of this case. The information can also be found at ncaa.org. The Committee on Infractions is an independent group comprised of representatives across the NCAA membership and the public. Members who reviewed this case include Greg Christopher, Chief Hearing Officer and Athletics Director at Xavier University, Bobby Cremins, former head basketball coach at Georgia Tech, Joel Matori, former University of Minnesota Athletics Director, Jim O'Fallon, law professor and faculty athletics representative at the University of Oregon, and Greg Sankey, chair of the D1 Committee on Infractions and Executive Associate Commissioner and Chief Operating Officer for the Southeastern Conference. Greg Christopher will now discuss the findings and decisions of the Infractions Committee. Following his opening comments, he will take questions.
Thank you, Emily. The Committee on Infractions decision details the findings and penalties in this case. Our comments today are designed to address your questions. However, the report stands on its own merits. This case stemmed from a series of articles published in September 2013 about alleged NCAA violations. The university alerted the NCAA to the allegations, and a joint investigation began. The investigation was thorough, with full cooperation from the university. Furthermore, and as a testament to their overall approach, Oklahoma State took the step of virtually complete transparency through this process, even posting the official notice of allegations for public viewing in October of 2014. In the investigation, more than 50,000 emails and other documents were reviewed, and more than 90 interviews of current and former student athletes, coaches, staff, and boosters were conducted. By the time we arrived at the hearing this past January, the university and enforcement staff were in agreement on most of the major points in the case. The investigation determined that many of the allegations from the series of articles were unfounded. However, the panel concluded that the university violated its drug testing policy and committed recruiting violations. As a result of the investigation and the subsequent hearing, the panel found that the university did not follow its drug testing policy, and the athletics department allowed the Orange Pride student group to participate in hosting prospects. From 2008 through 2012, the university did not follow its own written policies and procedures for students who tested positive for banned substances. Rules require that if schools have a drug testing policy in place, it must include substances on the banned list, and the school must follow its policy. The athletics director believed he had latitude in the application of the policy and deferred to the head football coach's recommendation on whether to suspend student athletes who failed a drug test. As a result, five football student athletes competed in a total of seven games when they should have been withheld from competition. Separately, over the course of 4 years, the university's Orange Pride program engaged in impermissible hosting activities during football prospects' official and unofficial visits. The Orange Pride is an all-female group organized and directed by the football program to participate in hosting during recruiting events. NCAA rules do not allow the use of student hosts in a way that is inconsistent with the university's policies on providing campus tours or visits to all prospective students. In our decision, we noted the university's continued use of the group, despite information distributed by the NCAA specifying that groups like Orange Pride for athletics recruiting was impermissible. While decisions made by athletic staff in this case resulted in NCAA violations, the panel did not find that the university failed to monitor its football program. Penalties and corrective actions self-imposed by the school and adopted by the panel include the following: a one-year period of probation starting today, going through April 23rd of 2016, $5,000 fine, a second $3,500 fine representing $500 for each of the seven games in which a football student athlete participated when he should have been withheld, The school and football program may not use the Orange Pride program and may not organize another student group to assist in recruiting prospects for 4 years. And the panel also accepted recruiting restrictions self-imposed by the school, a limit of 30 official visits per year during the 15-16 and then the through the next 2 years. Second, a reduction of coaches participating in off-campus evaluations by one during the 15 and 16, 17 years, and then a reduction in the number of evaluation days by 10 days in the fall and spring. So this concludes my opening remarks, and I think, Emily, you'll coordinate the question.
Yeah. Operator, can you please explain how reporters can indicate they would like to ask a question?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touchtone phone. You'll hear a tone indicating you've been placed in queue, and you may remove yourself from queue by pressing the pound key. If you are using a speakerphone, we ask that you please pick up your handset before pressing any buttons. Again, for questions, press star, then one. We'll first go to the line of Dan Wolkin with USA Today Sports.
Yeah, Greg, I'm curious about the admission from the athletic director at Oklahoma State that he didn't understand his own drug testing policy. This has also come up in a previous case that you guys have dealt with. I mean, how does the committee view something that, you know, seems pretty fundamental to the job of an athletic administrator, you know, to understand how their own policy works?
Yeah, Dan, I think as we spelled out in the report, if you start to get into the drug policy area in the first part of the report in page 3 or so, having a policy and having the oversight of the policy from a management standpoint, they had structure in place at the institution, and they had management in place, but there were mistakes made. So it's not something where we felt that there was a failure to monitor, per se. And again, if you get to the back of the report, we didn't believe there was a failure to monitor, per se, because they had a compliance program for a drug policy. They had a drug plan administrator. They had monitoring in place for Orange Pride, but you could say that the monitoring was there, but it was ineffective.
Okay, so if a school ignores their own drug policy and plays athletes who would otherwise be ineligible, that was not viewed as competitive advantage by the committee?
No, it was something we looked at in this case, and it was part of how we determined. And if you look at, again, back to the beginning of the report, the overall scope, probably a total of 1,600 tests and so forth, we thought this was rather narrow and limited in the sense that it was a fairly limited period of time, relatively small number of athletes, and a limited competitive advantage. It's not the NCAA's place, obviously, to have a set drug policy across all member institutions, all 351 member institutions, but we do expect schools to follow the policies that they come up with.
Hey, thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
So the line of Cliff Brunt with Associated Press. Go ahead, please.
Is it unusual, given the broad scope of the investigation and the amount of time and effort that was put into it, to find so few violations?
Cliff, I guess I don't know. I've only been on the committee myself, I think, about under 2 years, so I can't speak from a long historical standpoint. But at the end of the day, you know, there's no doubt that this case was, written about. It was highly publicized. Some salacious stuff was out there, a lot of unsubstantiated stuff that was not found. And it was not for a lack of looking. And I think the numbers indicate that when you say there were 50,000 documents that went through and nearly 100 interviews. But we have full confidence in the enforcement staff and the university. This was really one of the most cooperative investigations in recent history. So Again, we have full confidence in what came out of this, and at the end of the day, you know, the notice of allegations and the report today, there were three allegations on the table.
Our next question will come from the line of Kyle Fredrickson with the Oklahoman. Please go ahead.
Hey, Christopher, you know, you had mentioned that some of those statements in the series of stories that came out were unfounded. Was hoping that you could go into that a little bit more in terms of whether the sources who were used in those statements told you different information, or if other evidence that you found basically counteracted what those stories had reported.
Kyle, first of all, from a process standpoint, any sources didn't tell us anything. It was the enforcement staff and the university that did the joint investigation. And it's really, today is not to go into any postmortem of anything that was written about this case, other than, again, I think if you go back to October 14 when the notice of allegations came out, that framed where this investigation was going. And then today's report is really what we've got in front of us. And that's the three allegations on drug testing, Orange Pride, and then the failure to monitor. So those are the three things that are really on the table.
Well, next goes the line of John Solomon with TBNSSports.com. Go ahead, please.
Greg, a couple questions. One, there was a footnote in the report that says the NCAA enforcement staff admitted at the hearing it didn't review any of Oklahoma State's other teams' compliance with the drug testing policy. Did they explain why they didn't look into other teams, and should they have looked into others?
We asked that question, and it was simply from a collecting of facts standpoint. But again, the allegations were tied specifically to the football program, and there was a question that was asked. But since this was tied to one specific program, it was pretty straightforward. Your second question, John?
One moment, please, while I open that line back up again. Mr. Solomon, your line is back open.
Yes, thank you. This case also raises the question again about how athletic departments have varying drug testing policies, varying penalties, sometimes don't even abide by their own policies, as we see in this case. In your opinion, do you think there needs to be any kind of conference-wide or national drug testing policies so there are universal standards?
I think, the NCAA's role as a membership association or a membership organization is probably not in a place of dictating to individual institutions HR policies or specific drug testing policies in this case. But setting a framework with how we approach things is the same way accrediting agencies overview organizations at a high level with certain parameters. We expect institutions to guide themselves, and at the end of the day, those drug testing policies are really in place more from the standpoint of student-athlete welfare and making the best decisions for student-athletes.
And we'll move now to the line of Bill Halston with Tulsa World. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is Bill Halston. There's a reference in the document that was released today to exemplary cooperation, and you kind of addressed this with the Cliff Brunt question, but that's what I wanted to ask you, whether this was an indication that OSU's level of cooperation, was it above and beyond what the committee typically would see when a school responds to allegations like this?
Bill, I'm not going to say that it was above and beyond, but I will say that it was, and I don't mean that in a negative way in any sense. Again, it was complete cooperation. And at the end of the day, it helped get a great result. But this is really the model of the way the process should work. And thankfully, it works this way a lot. But I think the steps that Oklahoma State took from a transparency standpoint, also which I mentioned earlier, should be applauded because they were out front with this and addressed it with their alumni and their constituents in a very public manner to to address the issue. So, again, complete confidence in the end result we had because of the cooperation that Oklahoma State had with the NCAA enforcement staff.
And we'll now to the line of Mike Herndon with AL.com. Please go ahead.
Hey, forgive me if this was somewhere in a deeper report that I didn't see, but what was the four-year period that the Orange Pride program covered for the violation?
I'm going to go from memory here unless I can find it in my notes real quick. I thought it was 2008 to 2012.
Same.
Yes, that's what's in my notes.
Seeing no other questions, that concludes our call for the day. A recording of this teleconference will be available in the near future on the NCAA website at ncaa.org. Thank you for joining.